All right. So anyway, the fossil record. You know, this is one of those things that we're going to talk a lot more about in detail. But I want to point out too, before we get too far, is that there are two sections left in our class. We've got the fossil record, which we'll get into obviously tonight. And this is an interesting one for me. I particularly like this portion. It deals a lot with the fact that the evolutionary model does not account for the lack of evidence to support it. I mean, it's pretty interesting, pretty obvious in a lot of other ways, but anyway, the fossil record is a great piece of evidence for that. The question we're going to ask is really what really happened in the creation of the fossil record. And then, of course, does the fossil record provide proof of evolution? These things we're going to be talking about as we go. It's not just a simple answer to that question, but or to those questions, but we'll get to those. And then, of course, the last piece is the hydroplate theory. And this is definitely one of my favorite pieces, the hydroplate theory, because it is probably one of the best overall explanations I've seen for all of the geographic features that we see on the Earth, as well as some of the geologic anomalies that we see. And it answers the question of, well, where did the water come from? That's a big one. If you ever talk to people about the flood, and if they've thought about it seriously, one of the questions they're going to ask is, well, where did the water come from? Enough water to cover the Earth. And of course, then, where did it go? And then how does plate tectonics play into all of this? Which, you really don't understand the question of plate tectonics until you understand a little bit better about what hydroplate theory is. But we'll cover that, of course, when we get there. So the fossil record is one of the things that we'll cover here. This is probably a very standard explanation, if you will, or diagram of that you've seen in fossil records when you were in high school or college or elementary school, if you went to public school. And we'll talk about that, of course. And then, of course, the hydroplate theory, again, just as a couple of quick things. This is a photo of the Rocky Mountains in Canada. Now, there's peculiar because, of course, they're folded. Last time I checked, most mountains were pretty hard. So how did that happen? That's one of the things that the hydroplate will help to answer, as well as this. Of course, this is the a photo of the Grand Canyon. The Grand Canyon today, according to mainstream science, does not have an answer for how it was created. The best answer that they have, at least that I'm aware of right now, or the most accepted one, is the Colorado River. And that doesn't make any sense, considering how large it is. Hydroplate theory, a little bit more there. We'll talk about how all this stuff works and where it came from. It's pretty cool. We'll get to that eventually. All right, so let's move on to the fossil record. This is an important component in the discussion of creation versus evolution. When we examine the fossil record, it's really not all that complex. The fossil record is defined as the name given to the history of life on Earth as shown by fossils preserved in the rocks. So, as portrayed today, the fossil record is shown to span roughly 4.5 billion years from the evolutionary perspective. Its fossilized remains supposedly began somewhere around 650 million years ago. And here is a diagram of that from Encyclopedia Britannica from 2005. All essentially, this is very similar. You'll see these anywhere. But you have your approximate earliest fossils were found 650 million years ago. And then supposedly, and we'll talk about this more as you move up, it becomes more and more complex. And notice that the fossil record, of course, talks about evolution. And it talks about particular types of body types all of a sudden appearing and developing specific diversification traits and so on and so forth. We'll talk more about that, of course. So, as taught in the public education system today, fossils and the fossil record provide direct proof of evolution. Examine this quote taken from an elementary science book. It says, "Fossils offer the most direct evidence that evolution takes place. Fossils, therefore, provide an actual record of Earth's past life forms. Change over time, evolution, can be seen in the fossil record." This is a direct quote from an elementary textbook. So, for ease of illustration, we use the following diagram to illustrate the current design of the fossil record. There are the basic elements to the fossil record as described today. There are two major divisions. There's the Precambrian that you see down here at the bottom. That is roughly the time frame for fossils, anyway, between 650 billion years ago to 544 billion years ago. And actually, if you look some of this up, it'll tell you like 543 billion, 40 million years ago. I'm not sure where they came up with the 40 million versus the 544 billion. I mean, they got to be specific, I guess. It's pretty wild. I just rounded them. 650 to 40, 544 billion years ago. And here's one of the things, or excuse me, million years ago, not billion. Here's the interesting thing, too. That particular area is divided into three major sections, and we're not going to talk too much about the Precambrian stuff as far as individual naming, but they have, you know, the Hadean, the Archaean, and the Proterozoic era. It's like really got to break it down. Supposedly, again, in this last section of the Precambrian is where we find first fossilized remains of life. The Phanerozoic eon, which is 544 million years ago to present, which is supposedly the time that begins right after the Precambrian, it's the beginning of the Cambrian time, it has two major divisions. It begins, the demarcation between the two major divisions begins during the Cambrian period, and it represents the foundation of the fossil record. So the foundation of the fossil record is essentially here in the Precambrian and Cambrian era. It's divided into three major sections, the Paleozoic, the Mesozoic, and the Cenozoic era. Now, each section is then further divided and categorized, as you can see here, it's indicated by the blue, the green, and the brown. Each of these areas are then categorized into different subgroups or sub-eons. So, any guesses about how they identify the lines between these areas, or the lines between these eras? Here's a strata. Yeah, you're close. But specifically, by the fossils found in them. Okay? So by the fossils found in these different eras, these different layers of strata, that's how they determine how to name these. So one that always sticks out to people, how about this one? The Jurassic, which is, of course, famous for the Tyrannosaurus Rex, right? Dinosaurs, right? Okay. So, the question really becomes, is this an accurate representation of the geologic column, of what we know to be true in the fossil record? Well, this is the way that the fossil record is presented today, and it's designed to back up the evolutionary model, the evolutionary theory. So as we'll see, the creation model of the fossil record is considerably different. So there are two opposing theories that we're really going to have to deal with, and this is something that is true throughout our discussion. But you might remember a point that we discussed about theories, and specifically the ability to make predictions about or based upon those theories. So these predictions are then used to test the validity based upon the theory's premise. So, in other words, water temperature or the boiling point of water. You make a theory that it boils at this specific level, and that based upon the oxygen levels and so on and so forth, that your theory would say that at a higher elevation, water boils at a different temperature. So you make a prediction and you go test it, and then you prove the validity of your theory. So with this process in mind, we can make some predictions based upon the theories of evolution and creation, and then use those predictions to test both theories. So in order to properly test the two theories, they must be compared to the available facts. So we can't, the nice thing about geology is that you can't make it up. The information's there. The geologic column is as it is. The fossil record contains the fossils that it contains, and it's very, very difficult to fake it, although some have tried. But it's very, very difficult to fake a fossil. Okay? So, in this case, the geologic timetable when we put it to test, or when we put these two theories to test, the geologic timetable really becomes our measuring rod. So here's a couple of the predictions that we'll make from the evolutionary model. So we need to understand that based upon the evolutionary model, the predictions that evolutionary theory makes is that the oldest rocks would contain evidence of the most primitive forms of life capable of fossilization. So in other words, the lowest, the deepest we can dig, and again, this is, gets into your Precambrian era, we're gonna, the deeper we dig, the more information we're going to find based upon the most primitive forms of life. We're going to find those in that deepest layer. And of course, younger rocks that sit on top of those oldest rocks will exhibit more complex forms of life. So we should see a gradual change from very primitive to more complex. Of course, next would be gradual change from simple to complex life forms would be apparent. And this is one of the things that we'll talk about in detail about this supposed gradual change that should be found in the fossil record. And then, of course, transitional forms should be readily present. Because if you just think about the complexity of changing one organism into another, let's take a large organism that was actually quite prolific, the horse. And supposedly, and we'll talk about this in more detail, the horse evolution has been very clearly defined in the fossil record. We should find hundreds of transitionary species between a four-legged critter that very gradually changes into a horse. Anyway, so we should be able to find that based upon the evolutionary model predictions. Should be lots of them, absolutely. And we're not talking necessarily about many transitionary species, you know, as in many different kinds, but many of at least one kind, many thousands of at least one kind. Charles Darwin noted regarding the simple to complex transitional form that the number of intermediate varieties which formerly existed must be truly enormous. Again, based upon his theory, that is the conclusion you would have to draw, that there must be millions of intermediate varieties of all sorts of different species in between to really make sense of evolution, or in order for it to make sense. However, geology, and this is again according to Darwin, he says geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this, perhaps, is the most obvious and serious objection which can be argued against this theory. Okay? So, now Darwin suggested that the reason for this lack of evidence is the extreme imperfection of the geological record. In other words, he figured it was because they just hadn't found the fossils yet. That's essentially what he was saying. So they've got to be there, is what he said. They've got to be truly enormous. So we've got to find them. Well, we didn't find them. The truth is that since Darwin's day, there has been an amazing effort to research and record the fossil record. And the fossil record is actually very, very rich with information. An evolutionary geologist by the name of T.N. George out of Great Britain, he stated more than 40 years ago, "There is no need to apologize any longer for the poverty of the fossil record. In some ways, it has become almost unimaginably rich." This was in 1960. And we continue to make discoveries about the fossil record and continue to find species and so on and so forth since then. As a matter of fact, they're digging one of the largest dinosaurs ever found out of the snowy, is it the snowies? Little snowies? The little snowies out north. Huge. I mean, one of the largest dinosaurs ever found being dug out of Montana just a few hours north of us. Okay. So, at any rate, there is an unimaginably rich amount of information in the fossil record. So the problem of a lack of evidence from the fossil record was a problem for Darwin in 1859. However, that problem has not been resolved. It's still a problem today. So, looking at the other side of the coin, the creation model will predict that the oldest rocks would not always contain evidence of the most primitive forms of life. It would also say that younger rocks would not always contain evidence of more complex forms of life. And that a simple the complex progression of life forms would not always appear. Instead, there would be a sudden explosion of diverse and highly complex forms of life. And then, of course, there would also be regular and obvious absence of transitional fossils, since there were no transitional forms of life. In other words, you're not going to find all the transitional fossils because the creation model doesn't support that. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Like weather. Mm-hmm. So, flood is what you find a great variety of specimens depending on the geology and the topography of the area.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yeah, the logical answer, and this is, it's based upon a thought or an approach that the things that we see happening today are responsible for what we see in the fossil record with the fine layerings and so on and so forth. And so in order for all of this to work together, there has to be massive amounts of time between these layers as they're laid down. In order to support the evolution of different species, it has to be a massive amount of time. So it's one of those things that while common sense would dictate that, they're assuming that the way that it happened, the way that we see it happening today is the way that it's always happened. Uniformitarianism, that's the word I couldn't think of it at the moment. But yeah, so they basically set that aside and say, well, no, that can't be because we have to fit it within this model. So. Yeah, it does make it is obvious. It should be obvious, but on this point, though, the evolutionists and the creationists agree. And the point that we agree on is that the physical evidence for evolution must come from the fossil record. So Darwin, when he said that there must be many, many different transitionary forms, and that the fossil record is going to prove this out, I agree with him. If evolution is true, then we're going to have to find that information. We're going to have to look at the physical evidence in the fossil record to be able to prove evolution. So, evolutionist, I'm not sure if I'm saying this gentleman's name right, but LeRoy, I believe, or LeRoy Clark, had this to say concerning the location of physical evidence of evolution. That evolution actually did occur can only be scientifically established by the discovery of the fossilized remains of representative samples of those intermediate types, which have been postulated on the basis of indirect evidence. In other words, what he's saying is that in order for evolution to be true, it can only be proven by finding those transitionary species or fossils, I like how he puts it, that have been postulated on the basis of indirect evidence. In other words, if you were to say that in layman's term, a wild guess. Okay? But he continues. Now, assumptions. Right, non-provable assumptions. He continues, though, and he says, in other words, the really crucial evidence for evolution must be provided by the paleontologist whose business it is to study the evidence of the fossil record. So this was, of course, in 1955 is when he said this. Now, interestingly enough, in 1955, that was the approach that evolution was taking. That's the approach that evolutionary science was taking, specifically paleontology. They wanted to find those transitional species. So you really see an upswing in the last 50 years after 1955 of paleontological efforts. And, of course, they're discovering new kinds of dinosaurs and they're discovering all kinds of stuff. But what they're not finding are those transitionary fossils. And now that attention has switched from paleontological to biological or chemical. So, anyway, the problem of a lack of evidence from the fossil record was a problem for Darwin in 1859, as I mentioned, and it is still a problem today. So, what has the fossil record shown? As more and more finds have been discovered over the last century and a half, it becomes plainly obvious that the evidence from the fossil record strongly opposes the predictions of evolution and strongly supports the predictions of creation. So the things that we find in the fossil record do not help prove the evolutionary model. So consider the evolutionary prediction that the fossil record should reveal a simple to complex progression of life forms. With this in mind, we're actually going to talk about the Cambrian explosion. How many of you guys are familiar with the Cambrian explosion? A few of you? Okay. So the Cambrian explosion is, well, we'll talk about that in just a second. So, remember, Darwin said that we would find the evidence for the proof for evolution in the fossil record. And remember, specifically, that the evolutionary model would predict that we would find a slow and gradual change in species to find many different types of transitionary fossils. Okay? Now, the Cambrian explosion is an interesting one. We'll define it here according to Wikipedia, which is, of course, always your most accurate and reliable source of information on the Internet. Ha, ha, ha. Tongue in cheek there. Okay. The Cambrian explosion, or the Cambrian radiation, was the relatively rapid appearance over a period of many millions of years, around 530 million years ago, of most major animal phyla, as demonstrated in the fossil record, accompanied by major diversification of organisms, including animals, phytoplankton, and calcium microbes. Before about 580 million years ago, most organisms were simple, composed of individual cells, occasionally organized into colonies. Over the following 70 or 80 million years, the rate of evolution accelerated by an order of magnitude, as defined in terms of the extinction and origination rate of species, and the diversity of life began to resemble that of today. Okay. Basically what they're saying is that all of a sudden, here's all these different kinds of life forms. Okay? And well, over millions of years, but here's the thing, and we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail here in just a bit. The amount of time span that they're talking about in relationship to what they say the age of the Earth is, it's minuscule. Okay. So again, here's our fossil record. There are some key elements, of course, to the Cambrian explosion and to the fossil record. The foundation for the geologic column in the fossil record is the Cambrian and Precambrian time periods, as we mentioned, those two at the bottom. Okay, so the Cambrian explosion is basically biology's Big Bang. Okay, so we have a Big Bang explanation for the existence of the universe, and now the Cambrian explosion is essentially the biological Big Bang for the existence of all of the life forms from the Precambrian to the Cambrian time frame. There's a little demarcation there. It seems rather insignificant. However, the entire period lasted between 5 and 10 million years, okay? Supposedly, again. Now, in this 5 to 10 million years, so this particular Cambrian explosion supposedly took about 5 to 10 million years. That's how long the Cambrian explosion lasted.
Even though the demarcation is, there's no gap.
Correct. So, when they look in the fossil record, they find a very small span of geologic time based upon the fossil record in which all of these different life forms all of a sudden came into existence. Okay? So before that, and then they, of course, keep digging, they find another layer. And that layer that's below that is supposedly filled with very simple forms of life. And anything above that, then you find larger gradations of life. There's larger amounts of time, not as much variation within the body, so on and so forth. Okay? So, supposedly this time frame took only about 5 to 10 million years. Now, again, that seems like a long time. However, when you consider that the overall time frame that we're talking about is at least, according to evolutionary theory, 650 million years, 5 to 10 million years does not take a lot of, or it's a very small amount compared to the whole, especially when you look at the age of the Earth, supposedly at 4.5 billion years old. So, in this time frame, every major body plan suddenly appeared during this period. These same body plans, these designs, still exist today. Geneticist John Klotz explains some of the difficulties presented in the Cambrian explosion. So, first of all, I want you to kind of, we want to summarize this real quickly. Biology's Big Bang was the Cambrian explosion. It's a sudden appearance of complex multicellular organisms. They just appear all of a sudden, and we don't find, again, transitionary forms from before that. Okay? They all of a sudden just appear. Yes, sir?
These are essentially the same animals
yep.
that we find today.
Yep, like essentially like the horseshoe crab, or like lobsters, or mollusks, or jellyfish, or worms, or fish. What's that? According to the Cambrian, or according to the fossil record, it was somewhere around 540 million years ago. That's a good question. So that's exactly the question, Mike. So, and here's the thing, that they all of a sudden appeared. And the sudden nature of their appearances presents a fundamental problem for the evolutionary theory, which is exactly what Mike is saying. They all of a sudden appeared. It's not like it was a long and graduated amount of time. But here's the thing, and I always find this fascinating. Let me go back to my... Go back a ways. Where's my drawing? Okay, well, we're going to keep going a lot further than I was assuming. I can't find it now. Oh, well, I'll come back to it. There's a, in that particular, when you look at the fossil record, when you look at depictions of the fossil record, notice that in the Cambrian, in the Cambrian time frame, they always put very simple organisms in there. They don't show like two. They don't show the thousands of different body types that are represented in the Cambrian time frame. They only show a couple of the really simple ones, the ones that fit their model. Okay? Next week, I'll, Sue, help me remember, to bring some of the fossils that I have that are indicative, if you will, of what we'd expect to find in the Cambrian time frame. But anyway, so the Cambrian explosions, biology's Big Bang, this time frame supposedly lasted only 5 to 10 million years, and every major body plan suddenly appeared, and they still exist today. So John Klotz, he's a geneticist, and he says, all of the animal phyla are represented in the Cambrian period. It's basically major divisions, if you will. Okay, they're all of them. All the major divisions of animal phyla are seen, represented in the Cambrian period. So we're not necessarily going to find, you know, Chihuahuas and St. Bernards and Dobermans and all that, but all the major body plans are going to be found there. Okay. So, this means that every major grouping of animals is represented, leaving no room for a simple to complex development, especially between species or between kinds. So, let's take a really broad phyla, mammals, and another one, reptiles. Okay? If they're all found at the same time, there is no room for an evolutionary process between the two. No, there isn't. So we should be done. Okay, let's go home. But we're not. Okay? So, not only that, the Cambrian explosion contains no evidence of thousands of transitional forms required by Darwin's theory. So here's the thing. Okay, well maybe, all of a sudden, in that 5 to 10 million time, 10 million year time span, we have all of the major phyla develop all of a sudden, and we have actually a tremendous amount of fossilization and records of this in the Cambrian layer. So shouldn't we, within that layer, then be able to find all these transitionary species? Maybe it was just really sped up. All of a sudden, evolution sped up. We have all these different life forms, so we should be able to find those. Wrong. We have no evidence of transitionary forms at all, even though, according to the evolutionary model, we should find them. So it doesn't support, the Cambrian area does not support Darwinian evolution, and there are no intermediate forms found during this period at all. Another evolutionist here, his name is David Berlinski. He wrote a book called A Tour of the Calculus. Boy, there's a book that... New York Times number one seller there, I bet. You guys don't know how to name a book. He says, the Cambrian explosion is not just a case of all the major animal phyla appearing at about the same place in the geologic column. It is also a situation of no ancestors to suggest how they might have evolved. Okay? Interesting. And he goes on and he actually says that David Berlinski, he says there is no question that a gap exists, that there's a problem here, and evolutionists admit it. It's a big gap. It appears at the beginning of the Cambrian explosion over 500 million years ago, when great numbers of new species suddenly appeared in the fossil record. A little bit later on, we're talking about horse evolution. There's a particular name that I'm not going to give it away, but there's a particular name they gave to some to events like this that is ridiculous in its very usage in relationship to the evolutionary theory. But anyway, so we've got to ask the question, where are all of these different transitionary fossils? Where are they? Where are these observable intermediates that Darwin said had to be there? Well, we don't find them. The model of evolution does not agree with the evidence. So, nevertheless, though, we're not going to give up yet. Notice this quote. It comes from a textbook, biology, of course, Miller and Levine, 2002. It says, the Cambrian period, which began 544 million years ago, is marked by an abundance of different fossils. Why the difference from earlier periods? By the Cambrian period, some animals had evolved shells, skeletons, and other hard parts. Okay. Interesting. So, even the textbooks admit that there was a sudden appearance of complex life forms and are unable to support the claim of evolution with real evidence. In other words, they just say it. They just say, by the Cambrian period, some animals had evolved. They don't know how. They can't find the evidence to support it. But because it's basically pushed through a public education system that doesn't really support truth as much as it supports an agenda, they can say these things. And then guess what? You take a test. What's that, sir? Yeah, and you just have to take the test and regurgitate. Be a good little soldier and do what you're told, right? Truth, yeah, in the mind of the hearer. So, here's the thing, is that great claims like this, they are going to require some real evidence. So, let us next examine the claim of evolution from invertebrate to vertebrate. So, at the very basic level, here's that fossil record picture, by the way. Here's the Precambrian, and then here's the Cambrian. Notice they basically give you a little snail and a tail, and you know maybe what? Well, I'm not sure what that is. Maybe that's a fish. I don't know. But wait a minute. Where are the other all the different body types and the phyla that are represented there? Yeah. Yeah. Oh. Okay then. At the top of this area right here, the top of the brown there, if you were to take all of that, and that's the entire time span, the Precambrian explosion happened in a space that would not even fill that black line between the two. That's how quickly it happened. So, all of this information basically points us back to the fact that in reference to what the creation model would predict, that we would have a sudden appearance of all these different life forms, well, the creation model certainly supports that. So, the facts are supportive of the creation model. So, let's go ahead and look at invertebrate to vertebrate changes. Again, textbook, biology, Miller and Levine, notice the same guys wrote the book. It says, fishes are considered to be the most primitive living vertebrates. Okay. Similarities in structure and embryological development. Whoa, hang on just a second. Remember when we talked about a particular guy, what's his name, Ernest Haeckel? And he came up with that thing called ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And he talked about how, or supposedly, how all of the human beings' development and mammals' development and so on and so forth, more complex, quote-unquote, forms of life, go through all the stages of evolutionary development. And remember, that was proven to be untrue. It was proven to be false, like in the early teens of the 1900s. And I told you at the time, too, that it's still taught. So, embryological development, what is he referring to? He's referring to Ernest Haeckel's research that was proven to be false. But it was fantastic in its ability to supposedly prove evolution. So it's still referred to, although not directly, not by name, the concept is still referred to. So at any rate, he said, fishes are considered to be the most primitive living vertebrates. Similarities in structure and embryological development show that fishes and modern invertebrate chordates probably did evolve from common invertebrate ancestors that lived many years ago. Probably did evolve. And yet, there's not one single example in the textbook of an intermediary fossil to support that claim. The probably did evolve. Okay? Note that this assumption is being made without providing any fact, without providing any evidence. Here's a couple of examples here. This is an early; these are early fish, of course, according to the biology textbook that we just quoted from. You know, the thing that I noticed about these, and you probably do too, is that they always call these bony fish because they are rather strange to us. We don't see those kinds of fish around much anymore. You know, they're very strange body types. They seem to be simple or very drastic in their changes, which, of course, there are many fish with many different kinds of body types. But these are generally thought to be very simple and almost savage, if you will, in their appearance. Yet you continue on, and you have an invertebrate to a jellyfish or a trilobite to a fish, both of which are different phyla, different groups. Obviously, these guys, both invertebrates, but these have a harder body size or harder body composition. And jellyfish, I mean, they're called jellyfish for a reason. They're not exactly like, you know, bony fish like this dude here. And yet, we don't have those thousands of observable intermediates between the two anywhere in the fossil record. And yet, again, remember what the textbook claims, that they probably did evolve. We're not going to provide any evidence to support it, but we're just going to say it probably did happen. Yeah, you know, we're just, based upon our best estimates as we fit it into this particular mindset, we're going to say that that's how it happened. And at any rate, well, I don't want to give too much more away. All right, so where are they? We don't find them. We don't find those thousands of observable intermediates. Ariel Roth, he's a PhD in zoology. He wrote another book called Origins. Had this to say. He said, we have virtually no evidence in the fossil record or elsewhere for any changes of the changes proposed during this immensity of time, quote unquote. But the public hears nothing of this problem. Interesting. This is the biblical model, though, would definitely support a created after their kinds approach. So, again, what are the facts support for invertebrate to vertebrate evolution, quote unquote? Well, they certainly don't. It certainly doesn't support millions of observable intermediates. It supports created after their kind. So we find no supporting evidence in the fossil record of invertebrate to vertebrate evolution. Maybe we can find such to support fish to amphibian evolution. So again, we don't find any evidence to support invertebrate to vertebrate evolution. Interesting, if you can, I don't know if you can read this very well, but it says, in the Cambrian, it says the first chordates, basically those with the spinal cord, and first fishes, and then sudden diversification of metazoan families. But wait a minute. Those metazoan families are also present in the Cambrian. As you continue to move up, you'll see, first vascular land plants, and then all of a sudden we have first amphibians and jawed fishes diversify. Not appear, diversify. So it's a very clever way of saying, hey, this evolution is supported by the fossil record, although it's really not. Anyway, so let's talk a little bit about some of that supposed fish to amphibian evolution. Textbooks claim that lobe-finned fish evolved into amphibians. Now, amphibians, of course, are critters that can live in water and on land, and they spend a significant time of their lives in water. Frogs. Great example. It's probably the key example for amphibians, right? And so textbooks will say that these lobe-finned fish that have these bony components in their fins are, in fact, intermediary species, that they themselves evolved into amphibians. So because of these similarities, this is from, again, another biology textbook, scientists think the first amphibians were descendants of the lobe-finned fishes, a group whose modern members include the coelacanth and the lungfishes. From, of course, a textbook from 1998. Now, of course, another thing here, notice the words scientists think. Okay? They think that this is what happened. The claim here, well, this is an admission that there's not evidence to support the claim of fish to amphibian evolution, but that it is a guess, again. So they say, this is how we think it happened, but they have no evidence to support it. Otherwise, they would, believe me, if the evidence was there, they would point it out, and it would be all over the place. And every time they think they find something that's close to an evolutionary or a transitionary fossil, it's everywhere. Remember Lucy? Supposedly, okay, there's all kinds of problems with Lucy, but we'll talk more about that as we get to the human portion of this. So, at any rate, that supposed that lobe fin there supposedly evolved into legs. Now, evolutionists in the past used the coelacanth as evidence fish were evolving into amphibians. The claim was that the front fins were evolving into legs. Now, the coelacanth was supposed to be extinct for over 70 million years. Supposed to be, but in 1938, living coelacanths were found still living. The front fins were not legs. Guess what they were? Fins. Still fins. This is another misinterpretation of the fossil record created by evolutionists. So, what do the facts support? Creation after their own kind. Now, here's the interesting thing. You can still fish for these off the coast of Madagascar. Still. They're an extremely deep water fish. People still catch these things today, and you ask the natives of the area, yeah, we've been catching those for years. And now, when they were first discovered, though, rediscovered in 1938, it was a big deal. So, yeah. Oops. Yes, sir.
How many years of school, how much money do these scientists get paid?
Well, they don't get paid to think. So, anyway. So, here's a coelacanth. Again, can be caught today. Just look it up. It's pretty interesting. So, there's a bit of an issue here. And just at this, using this as an example of saying lobe fin fish develop into amphibians, and then we find those very same lobe fin fish, here's the problem. Not only does it destroy the evolutionary mindset or a theory, but it also starts to disrupt what we think we know about the fossil record and how those supposedly more simple forms of life, are found in deeper layers. Well, wait a minute. How did these living coelacanth crawl out of a 70-million-year-old layer of rock? According to evolution, they should be extinct for 70 million years. So, it's still a fish, still fins. It's not an amphibian, doesn't act at all like an amphibian. So again, the question becomes, what do the facts support? The facts support created after their own kind. So, the horse and the whale are a couple of other examples here. And of course, what always happens is that as you start to work through these things, the evolutionists will cry, well, what about all the well-documented intermediary species? What about all those examples? Well, without finding hard evidence in invertebrates to vertebrates or fish to amphibians, we move on to attempt to show the evidence of mammalian and avian evolution and discuss three famous transitions from four-toed small browsing animals to the horse, from land mammals to whales, and then from reptile to bird. Reptile to bird is probably one of the most common ones that you'll see today, because that one is very hot in terms of the evolutionary mindset regarding dinosaurs. It's because remember, if you've ever read any of the work that came out of the Museum of the Rockies, and Mr. Horner, or Dr. Horner, he basically said that the Tyrannosaurus Rex's closest living relative is not a lizard. It's a chicken. Seriously. So, obviously something we'll have to deal with. Says him. All right. So, these alleged intermediates, horse, whales, and Archaeopteryx. You've probably seen drawings of supposedly ancient half-reptile, half-bird critters that are could have may or may not have been able to fly. We don't really know. But this is supposedly an intermediary species between reptiles and dinosaurs. So, the horse, supposedly, is a well-documented case of evolution. This is from Microsoft Encarta from 2000. Here's a nice drawing there that helps you show from little tiny Eohippus things back into the modern horse and how these parts, they come and go and so on and so forth. So the horse, supposedly, and this is according to Microsoft Encarta Encyclopedia, the horse is a well-documented case study in evolution. The fossil record shows clear steps in the progression from a four-toed, small, browsing animal, one of a line that gave rise to tapirs, rhinoceroses, and other mammals, in addition to horses, to the modern horse. So according to the theory here of gradualism, new species of horses evolve slowly and continuously. Intermediate forms were common. According to punctuated equilibria, new species evolved rapidly during a short period of time. Intermediary forms were rare. Okay, so what they're saying is that according to the theory of gradualism, which is a sub-theory of evolution, that we should see many species of horses evolving slowly and continuously, where there are many, many different forms of intermediate fossils, right? But just in case they're not there, we have punctuated equilibria, which says that all of a sudden, they evolved quickly over a span of just a very short amount of time, so we're not going to find those intermediary species. Huh, that's convenient. So here's the problem. Obviously, this is from Life Sciences. I'm not sure I put the quote on there. Or the credit. It's from Life Sciences textbook, Prentice Hall, printed 2002. This textbook claims that if we find intermediate horse fossils, it is a support for evolution. But if we don't find intermediate horse fossils, it's also support for evolution. This is a nonsensical statement because evolution is claimed to be true with or without evidence. Whether you have the evidence or not, it's irrelevant. We're just going to say that it's true. And we're going to do whatever we can to develop new theories to fit into our model and make it appear true no matter the circumstance or the facts. So, it sounds like Catholicism. That's funny. Jonathan Sarfati, he's one of the guys that you've probably seen, and I know you've seen him in a couple of the videos that we've watched. He wrote this in his book, and from 1999, he says, as the biologist Herbert Nielsen said, the family tree of the horse is beautiful and continuous only in the textbooks. And the famous paleontologist Niles Eldridge called the textbook picture lamentable and a classic case of paleontologic museology. Basically, you're making it up. Okay, lots of big words there. But why would the evolutionists that he was referring to make this statement? Jonathan Sarfati didn't say it, he's quoting them. Why would they make this statement? Well, a couple of things. It says, the popularly told example of horse evolution suggesting a gradual sequence of changes from four-toed fox-sized creatures living 50 million years ago to today's much larger one-toed horse has been known to be wrong. Transitional forms are unknown. From Boyce Reisenberger, he's a senior editor of Science, and he wrote in the Houston Chronicle from 1980. So here's the thing. You look at both of these sets of information, both of these quotes, and these guys are beginning to figure out that, wait a minute, the information isn't there. We're not finding these transitionary fossils. We're not finding these intermediate kinds. We're not finding it here, and we're just going to say it flat out. It's not there. They're wrong. Just like Ernest Haeckel and his ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny nonsense, it's fake as well. These guys are starting to point it out. Well, here's the thing. The scientists find fossil horses mixed throughout all the different time layers. This is why they're beginning to say this, or this is why they started saying this so long ago. Because guess what? They would find these horse fossils all over the place. Just like we're finding the coelacanth alive today, and it's supposed to be extinct for 70 million years, we're finding horse fossils mixed throughout all the different layers. Not just where they're supposed to be, in the deeper layers than they should be, and they're finding in different fossil forms that are supposedly before the other ones, and layers above the other. It's a mess. So it doesn't support it. So the first animal in the series here, too, by the way, the Eohippus, is so different from the modern horse, and so different from the next one in the supposed series, that there is a big question concerning its right to the place in the series. So here's the thing. They find a four-footed creature with four toes, and they say, oh, hey, look at this. It kind of looks like a miniature horse. Oh, it's probably a miniature horse. And then they start to calculate from there that there must be many different forms of intermediate species. But the Eohippus doesn't look anything like any of the other ones. They don't even have a lot of the same body structures. One of the things that we talked about before, we talked about pendactyl limbs. You remember that? That's where there's basically five digits, if you will, within the limbs somewhere. Well, one of the reasons that they tie these things back together in the horse fossils is because of the way that the wrist bones in the horse hoof are somewhat related to the Eohippus fossils. But you know what? There's just as much similarity between our wrist bones and the wrist bones, quote unquote, kind of wrist bones, and a horse's hoof, or a horse's foot, ankle. Okay? So, at any rate, there's a lot of questions about the Eohippus, and as you saw from those quotes, it's lamentable, as some of those of the evolutionists were saying. So, here's, of course, what you find in a textbook. This is the gradualism, the slow and steady change from from this little critter up to a horse, and all these intermediary species. But yet, just in case we don't find them, we have punctuated equilibria, short periods of rapid change. And again, now, this is being presented in elementary schools. It's not like it's being presented to the peers for scientific review. It's already been approved, of course. It's not like it's being presented with any kind of a question. It's being presented as fact. So you learn to describe what's gradualism and what's punctuated equilibria. I can remember in my high school, early high school, late grade school biology classes, having to basically draw this out and explain how these are examples of evolution. And give me an example of what you think a punctuated equilibria, or an example of a punctuated equilibria you think might happen, might have happened. And you know what? My guesses were probably just as valid as theirs. Okay? So, the rib count, the things that the textbooks don't contain, is that the rib count, the vertebra count, the tooth count, and the size of the animal varies widely, and it does not show any direct line of progression. So, for instance, the rib count, for instance, 18, lose 3, oh, gain 4 more, oh, and then we're going to lose 1. Wait a minute, that doesn't show any kind of a nice gradual evolutionary change. These different critters are clearly different critters. They're not all the same class. Okay? You know, notice those line drawings. It's, you know, just the assumed that, hey, those are those transitionary fossils we haven't found yet. And really, the similarities between them is really more likely genetic variability in those that are the same or relatively the same. So you can look at other examples of horses and zebras and donkeys and so on and so forth. It's more likely genetic variability as opposed to some sort of evolutionary process. So there are a lot of different examples today, of course, of horses. There's the English Shire. He's over 6.5 feet tall is an example there of an English Shire, big horse. You have the ponies that are under 5 feet, pretty common for around here. You have the Falabella, which is under 2 feet, little tiny horse. And then, of course, many exist today that resemble extinct horses. So there's if supposedly little itty-bitty horse transitioned into one of these horses and into one of these horses, why do we still have these and these? It's a problem with the evolutionary model. Okay. The question is, what are the facts support for horse and whale? They are created after their kind. The next one we're actually going to talk about, we're not going to talk about today, but it's the whale. Now, just from what you know of the evolutionary theory, where do you think whales came from? Land mammals or water animals? Yeah? Supposedly whales came from land-dwelling mammals. Okay, then. And that's based upon... Yeah, might have been birds. Yeah, birds fell out of the sky, land in the water. No. Anyway, it's based upon some very, very specific pieces of physiology that for a long time they were thought to be pelvises that were no longer useful. And we'll talk about that as we continue on next week. So, we'll stop there for today. We'll pick it up with talking about the well-known example of whale evolution and how it supports or does not the evolutionary model. Any questions, comments? All right.